Yeah, I should probably say covariance. Next, when the coordinates are Cartesian, it becomes, we just get one, we get ddx alpha. The root g's are one, so it's f beta alpha, which is, you know, that's the divergence. Right, this is what it reduces to. So we conclude from those two things that this has to be, this is always the divergence. Because we haven't really slogged through the stuff that demonstrates that this is all coordinate invariant. That's why it doesn't feel like a proof.
Because
we haven't really delved in with coordinate invariant to this notation, and I don't want to. It's not that bad. And did you see the notes that I posted online? Sort of at the end of the exterior calculus section, I put some notes that I wrote for another class. And I do talk about coordinate transformations in those notes. So you may be able to see how the coordinate invariance is coming together from that. But there is another way to do this. We can show directly, if we have a functioning pen, that d alpha f beta alpha. Okay. We know what that is. This is the partial theta alpha plus f rho gamma theta rho alpha plus rho alpha here plus f beta rho gamma alpha rho alpha. Now, notice that the middle term, since this is anti-symmetric and this is symmetric, this term is zero by symmetry. You're contracting a symmetric rho alpha with an anti-symmetric rho alpha.
Right.
So, the divergence using our usual covariant derivative reduces to just two terms. And one of the terms is a trace of a gamma matrix. Let's study that a minute. Gamma alpha rho alpha is, okay, Christoffel symbol alpha beta g beta rho comma alpha plus g beta alpha comma rho minus g rho alpha comma beta. And now, this symmetrizes on alpha beta, so notice that these two terms anti-symmetrize alpha beta, so those two are going to cancel because of the contraction on alpha beta here. So we just have one term. We have a half g alpha beta, g beta alpha is the same as alpha beta, comma rho. Okay, that's kind of a simple looking expression. Let's see if we can write that as something simpler. In fact, we can. Let me see what. If we look at the determinant of the metric, that is, let's see now. All right, let's write it. Let's write it using epsilon. So we can write it as 1 over 4 factorial. We need a couple of epsilons here. Epsilon, just the determinant. Mu, nu, alpha, beta. Epsilon, gamma, delta, rho, sigma. G, mu, gamma. G, nu, delta. G, alpha, rho. G, beta, sigma. Okay, that's 4 times the determinant. There are a couple of minus signs in the 2 epsilon, so the 2 epsilon, the sign goes away. So the sign ought to be fine here. If I take the derivative of this, let me take the derivative of that determinant with respect to any Greek index I haven't used yet. How about tau? Then what I'm going to get is this constant. So I've got 4 metrics there, so I'm going to get a factor of 4. Whichever one this differentiates, I can shuffle the indices to bring them into line. So they're all equivalent. So I'm going to cancel the 4 and the 4 factorial. I'll have an epsilon mu nu alpha beta. And let me always, in each term, let me rename the indices so that I'm mu gamma g nu delta g. So I'm differentiating the last one. And then we've got this g beta sigma comma rho. And I want to ask what that thing in brackets is. Okay, so I've got some thing in brackets contracted with g beta sigma comma rho. No, sorry, tau. Comma tau. Is everybody with me? Any questions? The thing in brackets has 2 free indices. It's got a free beta sigma. Now, this is the thing in brackets. So, that part. Okay, the beta sigma are summed over here. Tau, the whole thing has a single tau. So, everything is contracted here except that beta sigma. Now, notice that if I contract with g beta sigma, what do I get? Well, I'm lowering the indices, but I get the determinant back. Right? What I get is this thing with one more g on there, which is just 4 times g. What that means, this can only be true if the bracket thing has to be 4g times a quarter g inverse. So thing, beta sigma, this can only be true if that's equal to g beta sigma times that determinant. It's symmetric, it's non-degenerate. That's the only way we can do that. Now have a very simple way to write the partial of g. The tau of g has to be equal to this stuff with that. Just g times g beta sigma times g, which is what we get, beta sigma comma tau, that's what we want. Here gives us now a very clever way to write this particular gamma. So I'm going to take this result here and write this as 1/2 over g times d rho of the determinant, which is 1/2 partial rho of log determinant of g. This way, I've been through this before. It takes a little while to establish this relationship. But this is correct. And it gives us a really cute way to write this divergence. What let me see. You got the... So now the divergence becomes d alpha f beta alpha is equal to the partial alpha of f beta alpha plus f beta rho contracted with this thing, 1/2 d rho log g. And I'm going to write this as, the half of the log I can write as the, log of the square root. So I have d rho of the log of the square root of g. Needs to be absolute values to make sense. The signs we could go check carefully. Let me dodge checking signs carefully, but you end up with absolute value here.
How do you get log again?
Divide by this g. So you have partial g over g is partial of the log.
Okay.
Yep. 1 over g times the gradient.
Okay.
Everybody else see it? You see that? So I've got d tau g over g is d tau of log g. Chain rule.
Yeah. That's what I was thinking. I was just making sure that it's right.
Sure. Yeah. Okay, any other reasons for plus? Oh, if you write it as log g, here's where you get it. It's really log f with that g. This ratio cancels the sign in any case. But a log is always of a positive argument, so we should have absolute values from there on. So we necessarily have absolute value g here. Okay. Now, let me write this as 1 over root... absolute value g times root absolute value g d alpha f beta alpha plus, okay, this, we just said is 1 over the square root of g times the derivative, so I pull out that 1 over the root from differentiating the log, and I get f beta rho times d rho of root absolute value g, close paren, and that is 1 over root absolute value g partial rho of quantity root absolute value g f beta rho. And there's the divergence.
Oh, good. That's not looking for it.
That's true.
Okay.
Yeah. I get it. Yeah, so it wasn't obvious, so I didn't want to... I used the short argument, the coordinate invariant. But it really is an equivalent formula. Because we've got this neat trait here, you know, some things just work with the divergence of an anti-symmetric matrix to make that formula happen. The divergence formula works for the same reason. If we just had the divergence of a vector and worked it out, the same argument would hold. You'd do the same construction and you'd get the divergence formula. So that divergence formula, before one discovered one could do it very easily with differential forms, took this ruling calculation to derive. Once having it, now you've got this very distinct formula, but you see now that differential forms gives a much easier way to get that formula. The divergence formula. Okay. That's a good question. It's something I sort of skimmed over.
If that's the divergence, what is the Laplacian? Yeah, just clear that.
Okay, recall the divergence formula we derive is on a vector or a one form. It's 1 over absolute root g d alpha of root absolute g of, then you need the components of a vector here. All right, this is the divergence of a vector v in general. Now, if we let v be g alpha beta partial beta of some function psi, we get the Laplacian or the wave operator. This is going to give us 1 over root g d alpha of root g alpha beta d beta phi. That's box or del squared. That's del squared of phi. Notice you've got two derivatives here.
So, where did phi come in? Phi is just
let your vector field be the gradient of something. So what I'm saying is the divergence of the gradient is the Laplacian.
Okay, so that's our function.
Yeah. So phi is the function. So the Laplacian or the wave operator, depends on what your space is, of a function is given by applying the divergence theorem to a gradient. You have to turn the gradient into a contravariant vector with an inverse metric, and then just apply the divergence formula, and you've got it. Okay. Good. Any other questions?
No. Well, what dimension are we in there, or any number of
dimensions? This is any number of dimensions.
Any n's or p's or forms?
There are none. There are none. We derived this formula using forms, and we agreed it worked in any dimension. So alpha runs from 1 to n in n dimensions. If it happens to be space-time, it runs 0 to 3, and one of them is a time-like dimension. But this holds in any dimension. So we've generalized the Laplacian. We've really actually accomplished something in terms of generalizing to notation that works in an arbitrary size space. And with arbitrary coordinates.
And it also works in a curved space, apparently.
It does.
Yeah. Okay.
Yeah,
if you wanted to give it a basis. I was going to ask, if you wanted to give it a basis, then why don't you just multiply it by E, and there it is.
If you wanted it in an orthonormal basis?
Yeah, or any given basis, do you have to do anything other than multiply it by?
This is arbitrary coordinates, so let G be given in some set of coordinates, and then just apply this formula. Now, if I wanted to express the Laplacian in an orthonormal basis, I would use differential forms to do it. An orthonormal basis is just a one-form basis if we're using forms. And let's see, what can I erase here? Can I erase over here now? Okay. So in an orthonormal basis, we know that we can write an orthonormal basis of one form as some linear combination of our coordinate bases. We've already mentioned that. Where A is Latin I'm using for the orthonormal basis, Greek I'm using for the coordinate basis. So in that basis, if I wanted to compute the covariant derivative. Here's one useful fact. We showed before that the metric is related to these coefficients by taking a pair of them on the orthonormal metric. So this eta is all diagonal plus or minus 1. If I take the determinant of that, that's what we call g, that is equal to the determinant of this times the determinant of that times the determinant of that. Well, this determinant is plus or minus 1. Then we get the determinant of d mu a twice, squared. So the square root of the absolute value of g is just the determinant of this coefficient matrix. So you start to suspect that these formulas might look simple in a normal frame. They more or less do. Let me see what they would be, though. How would I do it any differently? See, the divergence is star d star of a one form. All right, so if omega is omega mu dx mu, where omega mu is just what we get if we lower the components of our contravariant vector, then the divergence of that vector is given by this formula. You know, that's it. This is div omega. The thing is, it really is coordinate invariant notation. It doesn't care what basis we use. So we can work through this formula by writing omega in an orthonormal basis. I suppose it wouldn't hurt to run through that again.
Just a question real quick.
Mm-hmm.
If E is orthonormal, then isn't the determinant of E 1?
No, the determinant of the metric is plus or minus 1.
Well, yeah, but
That's where this came from. E actually is, you can think of E as the metric in a mixed basis. You know, one index in the orthonormal, one in the coordinate. It's how you go back and forth between the two bases.
Okay, I was going to say.
So, yeah, this form is your basis vector. This dx is your basis vector. E just connects them. That matrix just connects them. So,
one's orthonormal, one's not. So you get funny things.
Okay. So I can write this differential form in any basis I want. I can write it in a coordinate basis, or I can write it in an orthonormal basis. Where these are my basis vectors there. Well, let's write out the divergence formula in this form and see what happens. We have star d star omega is star d. Now we have to take the star of that thing. It has components omega a. Now we use our orthonormal metric, and we've got e b c d. Let's see, how many is it? Let's do n dimensions here. C through D, and then we have E C wedged with everything up to E D. So we use it just the same way we use the DXs, right? Here we've got an n minus 1 form, so I have 1 over n minus 1 factorial. I don't do anything differently, really, except that differentiating this thing is simple because that's constant, but taking D of these things might be something. So the how do we do that? We need to know what D of those things is. In a Euclidean space, these coefficients should be constant, but they're not in general. So let me see what we have to do here. We have a bunch of DEs. That gets sort of messy. So we've got n minus 1 factorial. Now we have to take D alpha of all this stuff. So we've got these coefficients. The AAAB is no problem. This thing has a root determinant of G, which is just a determinant of E in it. Then we've got an epsilon BC through D. And then we've got all of these things.
Oh, this is actually going to be nicer than you think. You got epsilon and E. When you pull out that B over here, you're going to get a... looks like you're going to get a another determinant of E.
This part gives us a determinant of E. Okay, so... yeah. Oh, that's good. Almost. If we had another one on there,
it would be. What is it?
Let's
take one.
Let's see.
I have to use that same computer over here.
Where could I get another? You know, I could write this as, I can write A to AB as a metric, an inverse metric, E mu A, E mu B. And I can take that E mu B onto here and almost have a determinant. I'm still missing a form though. And I also need, there should be a dx alpha in here. Keep forgetting that.
What's that?
The determinant is the matrix E.
Oh, I see. Okay.
That's this.
Oh, okay.
Yeah. This is the one thing you always run into if you're working in orthonormal frames. Taking a derivative of an orthonormal frame gives you something. Right? You don't... that's not nothing. It's something. Those are a bunch of functions there. And what you end up doing is going back and forth between orthonormal and coordinate frames. It's easiest to take derivatives in a coordinate basis because the derivative of dx is zero. D of dx is zero. But it's easier to do other parts of the calculation in orthonormal frames. So anytime you see a derivative coming up, it's best to throw everything into coordinate basis, take your derivatives, then you can turn it back into orthonormal. That's what I would do here, and basically I'd end up, you know, doing it the way we did it before. So let me not take too much time. Yeah, sure.
That what is often referred to as the preferred frame when it's done that way, even though you're talking about invariant objects and
preferred frame.
Well, yeah, Flanders uses that a lot. He calls it a bullseye.
Oh, preferred frame. You know, he might be talking about a Cartesian frame. I'm not sure what he's talking about. I'd have to take a look at the book. You know, a priori, there is no preferred frame. But, you know,
in some of the older texts, they use that in
Cartesian coordinates, in a flat space, there exists an orthonormal coordinate basis. But only in flat space, and the coordinates are Cartesian, right? So dx is I hat, right? But that's the only place it happens. You got to be Cartesian and flat, and then there exists this one orthonormal coordinate basis. It's a nice one to use. That's why we're always doing Cartesian stuff, because that is very nice, and that may be what he's talking about. I'm not actually sure. I'd have to check, but that's certainly a nice basis to work in. I don't want to actually take the time to do this because I don't think it's going to be anything that, you know. I think I'm going to end up going back to the coordinates here, and it'll be just like what we did before. Well, I'm happy to show that to you if you want to rederive the diversion formula, but it's star d star. You guys know how to carry that through in coordinates. That's the easiest way to do it. You can then put the answers in terms of a coordinate basis, and you know, an orthonormal basis. Maybe that's the easiest thing to do. So rather than doing this, let's just translate. We know that the divergence is star d star omega in coordinates is this thing. It's 1 over root g d alpha root g of omega alpha up. And this is 1 over e. If I want that to be an a, I can make it an a by putting an inverse. Okay, so remember we've got this matrix, the function alpha a, its inverse is e a beta that gives a Kronecker alpha beta. So this is the inverse of that. This has the Greek up instead of the Greek down. So if I use one of those, I can write a alpha d alpha here, but I can't do that unless I really need to be multiplying by a Kronecker. So I can write e alpha a e a beta d beta of e then omega alpha. And write that as 1 over E. Now, I can think of this as an orthonormal frame derivative. So let's leave that written this way. But I want to move this inside. Well, I can do that almost. I can bring it inside, but then I have to subtract its derivative, because I can't bring it inside the derivative without consequences, so then I have to subtract e a beta d beta of e alpha a, and then we just have this e and the omega alpha floating around, which is sort of ugly, and that's not orthonormal yet. This does become the orthonormal omega. So the first term is...
Before you get too far ahead?
Yeah.
Where you've got that arrow, and I see root absolute g, that substitution, but I don't understand these two other e's in the middle.
Oh, this is a Kronecker alpha beta. This time it's inverse.
Okay, I see that.
So I can multiply by 1, that's just d alpha. So this d alpha is written as a Kronecker times the beta.
Okay.
The Kronecker I've written as a product of the E inversion. Then I bring this inside, but I have to subtract the derivative to do it. Now, the thing that we're going to see eventually is, let me do a trick on this. Because this is minus 1 over E. Now, I want to write this term as the derivative of the product minus the derivative of that. It's an integration by parts, essentially. Or it's a product rule. So think of this as half of d beta of the product. So I can write it as d beta of ea beta e alpha a minus e alpha a d beta ea beta, like that. And then we've got the E and the omega alpha out there. But this is just the Kronecker delta again. So that derivative goes away. And what I'm left with is plus this. This E alpha turns that omega into an orthonormal omega. Oh, okay. So star d star omega is equal to, all right, we've got this stuff, 1 over e, e a beta d beta of e omega a. Then we have plus 1 over e. That first term goes away. Then we have d beta E A theta times E omega A. The E goes away, and so finally we've got E A just about E theta E omega A. So we've expressed the whole thing now in terms of orthonormal stuff. This, you won't be too surprised to learn, is related to that trace of the gamma that we found was derivative of log. Right? Derivatives of E give rise to the connection. You can write the Christoffel gamma in terms of derivatives of E. It's sort of messy, but this is related to gamma. And that's that trace term that comes into the covariant derivative. It's not exactly equal to that trace term, but it's related. It's part of it. So there's the form. If you happen to be working with the orthonormal components and want an expression, you can get it. Any more questions?
Yeah. Not related to this actually, but last time you were saying that to get this divergence formula, you were saying that you define epsilon with the indices up the same as epsilon with the indices down.
Well,
you know,
the last time we did it, right, we put a minus sign in epsilon. The time before that, we defined it to be the same.
Right.
So we gave two different definitions.
Okay.
The one last meeting was different than the one the meeting before that.
Okay.
Either one's okay as long as you're clear which way you've defined it. Okay, you can use either one. It's going to mean different signs sort of through the rest of your calculation, so you just have to be clear what your definition is.
Okay.
I don't know if I actually have a preference. Either one's fine.
Okay.
It's just a definition.
Right.
Oh, did you get the paper right?
Yeah, I
don't really remember. Yeah, some of it's easy reading, some of it's sort of complicated stuff, and, you know, I'm still wrestling with it, but it may be some stuff we'll be looking at, so you might give it a read and see what you can get out of it. It's neat stuff, too. It's sort of fun. Okay, so shall we return to group theory? Good. If you have questions on differential forms, I mean, you're working on those problems, you know, go ahead and ask.
I'll ask a silly question. Remind me of what the B with no indices is.
The B with no
the E.
The E with no indices. E is the determinant of E alpha A, which in fact is the square root of the determinant of G alpha beta. Probably guessed it right.
Okay. Yeah, that's
yeah.
Okay. As soon as you said it was the determinant of E alpha A, I got it.
Yeah. It's sort of strange to write formulas with it. You just got this E floating around.
That's weird. Yeah.
I've gone ahead and done a little bit with you here with orthonormal frames. We're going to be seeing more of these guys later on when we do a gauge theory of gravity. Those will be our gauge fields, some of them. So, you know, we'll get a lot more about these orthonormal frame fields, also called solder forms or sphere binds or field binds. There are many names for them. They're important quantities. And they are the gauge fields associated with translation. But we'll do that explicitly down the road. Okay. I was giving you a very quick catalog of a bunch of lead groups. Orthogonal groups, symplectic groups, general linear groups, special linear groups. The simple lead groups fall into a few broad families. The special unitary, the special orthogonal, the symplectic, and there are some exceptional groups.
And remind me again what the symplectic group is. I remember
they preserve an anti-symmetric matrix.
Okay.
A non-degenerate anti-symmetric matrix. In general, it can be put into the form sort of an identity here and a minus identity. So, it's a good way to think of a lead group in terms of what it leaves invariant. It's a very concise way to define them and to find out exactly what they do. So, looking more at lead groups, we could do some examples. I want to show you some general technique. It might be clearest if I do some examples first and then show you the general form. Let me describe the general approach a little bit, though. The idea is, you know, because these things are continuous, what we can do is look at infinitesimal transformations. And those infinitesimal transformations turn out to be enough to reconstruct what the whole group does. Let's go back to our simple example. We worked out SO2, the rotations of a plane. We worked those out in detail. Let's see how this procedure works when we apply it there. There's only one transformation. There's a little bit of the detail that we're going to lose, but you'll see how this thing comes together. So we have SO2. And if we have an element of SO2, we know that we can write it as G of theta and represent it as a 2x2 matrix of sines and cosines. Now, let me start from a little bit more fundamental point of view. Let's define it as the group that leaves the two-dimensional Euclidean metric invariant. So, or SO2 is the set of linear transformations transformation. Preserving delta ij equals 1, 0, 0, 1. Transformations, let's say, of R2. So we have some transformation. We have a group element. We're going to write it as a matrix, ij. It acts on some xj to give some new x tilde I. And what it has to do is I'm working backwards here again. I'm ending up where I should have started. I want to get to this. I want to get to it from this. I want to get to this from this. Okay. So what I want to say, let's start over. Over here. I've got a Euclidean metric. I want the set of transformation. Let's preserve it.
Let's figure out how we can represent that.
So, we seek transformation. The Euclidean norm on R2.
Okay, so this is our starting point.
The Euclidean norm is it's a dot product of vectors, or it's a norm of squared of a vector. We can write it as the Euclidean. It's a Kronecker with a pair of vectors like this. It's a bilinear symmetric form, a particularly trivial one, in two dimensions. I, J run from 1 to 2.
Right.
So now we want the transformations, the linear transformations, I'll go ahead and call them G again. So we want to look at linear transformations, so we can write it as matrices, that take x to some new x, and we want to find matrices G, I, J, such that the norm of the new vector squared tilde vector is equal to the norm of the old one squared. Like that. That's the condition we want to impose. Of course, these are rotations. These are orthogonal transformations. But
let me say there's not going to be much to keep that invariant. Like, if you apply it to that.
Well, there's just one parameter family.
Yeah.
I mean, we know the answer in this case.
No. I was talking like if you look at it this way, the way it's worded, it almost seems like you throw it on to your metric and see if it changes the metric. And I was going to say whatever you do is going to change the metric.
Well, not really, because a matrix transforms by similarity. So you're sandwiching this between a pair.
Oh, okay.
So there are some things you can do. Yeah, single matrix, nothing will do it.
But two matrix.
But, it'll be similarity, because this is a quadratic form, right? So we require delta ij xi xj has to be equal to delta ij x tilde I x tilde j. And now we substitute, and we have G I K X K, and we have G J L X L. I think we ran through this last time. It probably won't hurt you to see it another time. So let me rename these indices so things match up better. If we have K L X K X L, has to be equal to delta I J G, let me not write the bracket, G J L X K X L. So group things that way. I'm writing the same thing here. I've dropped the bracket on the G, but those are matrices.
I think you use O last time.
I used what?
O.
O?
Yeah.
Did the same thing last time with O.
Oh, then I'll try.
Okay. So, it's a group element, so I want to call it G today. This says that the symmetric part of these has to be the same, but they're both symmetric already, so it says that delta KL has to be equal to delta IJ GIK GJL, and I can write that as delta I j times g j k is normal matrix multiplication because I'm summing adjacent indices. But here, if I write G transpose KI, so flip the indices and call it the transpose, and it's the same matrix, so that the transpose of the transpose is the same. And what this says is the identity here has to be G transpose times the identity times G, or G transpose has to equal G inverse. So we get the orthogonality condition that we've seen before. But now I want to do something a little bit different that gives us a systematic approach to Lie groups. The thing I want to do is get us a simpler way of analyzing a condition like that. This is a quadratic equation, a quadratic system. You know, that's really four quadratic equations. So, you know, by the time you resolve all those, you could be solving some horrendous polynomial thing. Now, in fact, it's not so bad. You can solve that. That one's not bad. But a quadratic condition is a nasty thing to solve algebraically. So we're going to linearize it. What we want to do is simplify by looking near the identity. Looking at infinitesimal. Transformation. That's too long to work right very often. So what I want to do is only rotate a very little bit. And from the continuity of the group multiplication, I want our parameter to be some small parameter. I want to write this matrix IJ as the identity matrix plus some small epsilon IJ, where the magnitude of any of the epsilon IJs is much less than 1. I'm going to neglect order epsilon squared. That will make this linear. So what we get is Kronecker IJ has to be equal to delta KI plus epsilon KI let me write it the way I had it up here. KL here. KL, then I have delta IJ Kronecker IK plus epsilon IK Kronecker JL plus epsilon JL. There we go. And then we just multiply these matrices out, and the metric times two Kronekers just gives us the delta KL. Then we get the metric times an epsilon times a Kronecker, and the metric lowers the I and makes it a J, and then the Kronecker is going to turn that J into an L. That's those two terms. Then we have the first Kronecker with the last epsilon. I can lower the I to become a J. That's the Kronecker. I can lower the J to become an I here. So I have a Kronecker IK with the epsilon with the J lowered to be an I times L. Plus order epsilon squared, we're going to drop. Well, the delta KL cancels, so dropping that and using these Kronekers, we see that epsilon LK plus epsilon KL has to be 0. What's it tell us about epsilon?
What kind of matrix is epsilon?
Anti-symmetric.
It's anti-symmetric, yeah. Epsilon LK is the transpose of epsilon KL, and you get a minus sign. Any questions?
What is the delta I base in the first place?
Is it here?
Yeah.
That's the metric.
Oh, okay.
That's the...
Oh, yeah, yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Well, 2x2, anti-symmetric. So, epsilon ij has to be... some multiple, presumably a small multiple, of the only anti-symmetric matrix in sight. There is only one up to a multiple in two dimensions. So it has to be of that form. So now we expect a one-parameter family of transformations. So an infinitesimal rotation is an anti-symmetric matrix times X. Now, let's just look at that a second. What we're saying is Gij is delta ij plus epsilon. Then we have to raise that index, so we need a delta ik times epsilon kl. Well, raising an index with the Euclidean metric doesn't actually change anything. So this is 1 plus epsilon times 1 minus 1 this way. So this is what we're talking about. And notice, if we let that act on an x, what do we get? So x tilde I is this acting on x. So we can write this as 1 minus epsilon 1 on x y, and what we get is x minus epsilon y and y plus epsilon x, and if we that's equal to x tilde y tilde. So if we look at x tilde squared plus y tilde squared, that's the Euclidean norm, right? That's equal to x minus epsilon y squared plus y plus epsilon x squared, and that's x squared minus 2 epsilon xy plus epsilon squared y squared, which we neglect, plus y squared plus 2 epsilon xy plus epsilon squared x squared, last term we neglect. Those two cancel, and we've preserved the norm. So, woo, it worked. So the linear order, that transformation does preserve the norm. That's what we promised, and that's what happened. That's the main thing. That sometimes that works. Question, Neil?
Okay. I got a little bit lost at the step. And I guess the Gij equals delta Ij plus epsilon.
Okay, that was our... Okay, here. That's what we set out up here.
Okay.
Right, we're looking at something close to the identity transformation. It differs by some matrix with small components.
Right.
And then we impose the condition, this condition, on that small matrix, and we find that that small matrix has to be anti-symmetric.
Yeah, okay. And so we're plugging in the anti-symmetric...
So we find the most general infinitesimal anti-symmetric thing,
okay,
and go ahead and plug it in and see if it works, and it does.
And then you just crank it out.
Right.
There.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And then we can check and make sure that it...
Oh, yeah, yeah. We knew it worked because we derived it.
Right.
So, you never have to check, right?
You always have to check three ways.
But it works. We got it right.
Okay.
Yeah, that was just a check. I mean, the general thing works, but... You know, I might point out that the first place in this calculation I've used the fact that it's two-dimensional is when I actually came back here and tried to write them all. explicitly. Everything else works in n dimensions. So what we're doing here actually holds for any orthogonal group. In fact, any pseudo-orthogonal group. We're handling a third of, you know, this classification of Z groups here. The same technique is going to work. In fact, the same technique in general works for any of these Z groups. If we know what they preserve, we can find what they look like. But let's press on. This is just an infinitesimal, and we've had to throw out the quadratic stuff.
But it does tell us that it's quadratic and that it's anti-symmetric, or it's got an anti-symmetric part.
Okay, the trick is to do a large number of infinitesimal transformations. So, for a finite transformation, consider this thing. Do you think these other markers work? Yeah. Okay, so consider the limit as n goes to infinity and epsilon goes to zero. So epsilon goes to zero makes this thing rigorous. What I want to do is apply an infinitesimal transformation n times, we're going to apply it infinitely many times, and we're going to make them infinitely small, but what we're going to do is require n times epsilon to remain finite, to remain non-zero and not infinity. So we want to carry out this limit. This isn't hard. We have a nice explicit form for that epsilon ij. It's this matrix. So this should be g, and the parameter we could take to be n times epsilon. So we end up with some finite parameter to characterize what we hope is a finite transformation. We'll call that number theta if it works out right, or theta over 2, or we'll see what it works out to be. So we want the limit of, all right, this is the identity matrix plus epsilon times 1 minus 1 to the n. And we can use the binomial formula here. This is the sum of terms, k equals 0 to n, where we take n choose k. I'm using the binomial formula here. I think we wrote it a couple weeks ago. Then we get this epsilon to the n, 1 minus 1 to the n, and then we get the identity to the n minus k. It's symmetric in these two. You know, you can interchange k and n minus k. So I put the n minus k on the 1 because it's going to go away. 1 to the n minus k is just 1. So here's the limit as n goes to infinity of that sum. But we've got to fuss a little bit with the sum before we know what it is. We want the limit of the sum on k. This is n factorial over k factorial, n minus k factorial. And epsilon is going to go to 0. So what I want to do is multiply by, that's k here. You were all about to say that. K and n minus k, binomial formula. I've got an epsilon to the k. I'm going to make it n times epsilon to the k, because that's going to stay finite. But that means I need to divide by n to the k to keep my counting right. Then we have 1 minus 1 to the k. 1 to the k is just 1, so I can drop that. Now, let's plus with these coefficients.
So G of N epsilon is going to be the limit as N goes to infinity. And, that's fine. Of sum 0 to N, then let's simplify this. N over N minus, N factorial over N minus K factorial, I can write as N minus 1, N minus 2, all the way down to N minus K plus 1. And then I divide that by, I've got an N to the K, and I've got K factorial. Then we have N epsilon to the K, and we have 1 minus 1, a matrix to the kth power. Okay. Now, the N is showing in fewer and fewer places. Let's get it down to really few places. What I want to do is, how many terms have I got here? If I count 1, 2, here I've got k minus 1, one more is k. So I've got k terms in the numerator. I'm going to divide each one by n, and that takes care of the n and to the k in the denominator. So that I've got 1 over k factorial, and then the factors in the numerator become 1 minus 1 over n, because I'm dividing each one by n, 1 minus 2 over n, down to 1 minus k minus 1 over n, and then 1 minus 1 to the k. Everybody see it?
What about
that
n to the
n? What that is? Yeah, let's, we should give this thing a name. Let the limit of n epsilon be, let's just call that theta. I think that's what it turns out to be anyway, but it's some finite number theta. So G of that theta is going to be, now we can take the limit. So we end up with a sum, k equals 0 to infinity. Then we have theta to the k over k factorial. That's nice. Then each of these finite number of terms, for any k, that's a finite number of products of things which, in the limit, each go to 1. A finite number of products of things approaching 1 is going to approach 1. So all of those go away, and we just have this matrix to the kth power. So that's our general group element. Let's look at how does that thing look like. If I square this thing, I get minus the identity. Minus the identity. So if I cube it, I get minus the thing again. If I take it to the fourth, I get the identity.
Do any terms go away because of the infinity?
Yeah. Do which?
Like the 1 over n, the 2 over n, do they disappear?
N goes to infinity.
The limit.
Yeah. Okay. Yeah. So. Now, if I had an infinite product of those, it's not so obvious. If you have an infinite product of numbers, each of which is slightly less than 1, the infinite product is 0. For any finite n, if k went to infinity, and I had an infinite product of things, each of which is slightly less than 1, the product of an infinite number of numbers less than 1 is 0. You know, 1/2 to the infinity is 0.
Oh, yeah.
Right. Every fraction is nilpotent in some sense, right? But it's a high order nilpotent. But k, in any given term, k is finite. And the product of a finite number of numbers less than 1, okay, is some finite number less than 1. But now I can take the limit
as n in that finite number goes to infinity, and each of those approaches 1, so I have a product of a finite number of things approaching 1. So the bigger n gets, the closer that number gets to 1. In the limit, it is 1 for each finite k term. So, yeah, so each of those becomes 1, we get 1. So I've taken the limit now, I just need to work out what the powers of this matrix are. And it turns out that odd powers, so if I have minus 1, 1, 2, let's say the 2s plus 1, some odd power. Well, if s is 0, I get this thing. If s is 1, then I get the thing cubed, which is minus that thing. So I'm going to get minus 1 to the s times that matrix for odd powers. For even powers, what I get is, right, if s is 1, I'm going to get minus 1, so I get minus 1 to the s again, times the identity, like that. If s is 1, it's minus the identity, good. So I know how to take all powers of that matrix. So now, let me come back to the beginning. So g of theta is equal to the sum. Let's separate. Let's separate the even and odd. So that the even series, S runs from 0 to infinity, but I'm just looking at theta to the 2k, to the, sorry, 2s, over 2s factorial. I'm just choosing the even terms, and then I have minus 1 to the s times the identity matrix. For the odd terms, I also have a sum 0 to infinity, and now I have theta to the 2s plus 1 over 2s plus 1 factorial, again minus 1 to the s, and then the matrix 1 minus 1. Anybody recognize those sums? For what? These matrices come out. They're constant now. So what I get is the identity matrix here times this sum, that's cosine theta. Then here I get the anti-symmetric matrix, that's called my generator of infinitesimal transformation, infinitesimal rotations, right? And this is the odd sum, that's sine theta. And we add those together. Identity times cosine, and minus sine theta, and by magic, we have constructed the general rotation of the plane.
So you use that infinitesimal trick to find out what the second matrix is, and then go through this summation trick.
Exactly.
Okay.
So here's the only kicker. There's, in general, going to be more than one infinitesimal transformation. If we do rotations of three dimensions, there are three independent ways we can rotate. So there are going to be three infinitesimal generators. And we have to exponentiate. This looks like an exponential, right?
Right.
This is the exponential of what? Of theta minus theta. Right, if I just bring this inside the matrix, that's the exponential of that matrix. Right. Oh, sorry. Okay. Yeah, bits are cheap. it's the usual exponential sum of 1 over k factorial times something to the k. In this case, k happens to be a matrix, but that's a perfectly reasonable thing. So, a lot of the properties of this are general. You have some invariance that defines a group. You look at
What that implies for the form of the infinitesimal generators of the group. You take a general infinitesimal generator, and you go through this very same construction, and what you find is that you end up exponentiating the infinitesimal generator with the finite parameter. And that gives you the full group element. So we get all of the finite transformations by exponentiating the infinitesimal generators with arbitrary real parameters. Those limit parameters become the n real parameters that define our n-dimensional Z group. So let's do another group. Any questions on this one? You want to do another? Are you tired? How are you doing? Another example? Wavering?
Sure. I could go either way, honestly.
I might conk out in the middle of the next one, but
I'd like to hear you say what you just said over the last minute again.
We're getting a consensus, I see. About this or about what we might do next?
Where you started at the exponential.
Okay. Here's the general procedure. What we went through here was we looked at a neighborhood of the identity. We looked at infinitesimal transformations, you know, very close to the identity. The invariance condition that defines the group gave us some constraint on the form of those matrices. In this case, they had to be, you know, it had to be one of the anti-symmetric 2x2 matrices. In general, there will be some form that those infinitesimal generators have to take. Now what we do is we take a limit of an infinite number of increasingly infinitesimal transformations such that they're described by finite parameters. And what we find, you know, this counting is going to hold in exactly the same way no matter what that generator looks like. We're always going to end up with a formula that looks like this, which is really the exponential of a finite parameter times the generator. This will always happen. So the finite parameters times the generators, right, those are real linear combinations of some, in an n-dimensional group, an n-dimensional matrix, they form a vector space. That vector space is called the Lie algebra. And so what we're doing here is exponentiating an arbitrary element of that vector space, of that Lie algebra, of the vector space of infinitesimal generators.
The Taylor expansion of cosine?
Just a flick. cosine theta is, okay, what we have is 1 over k factorial times the kth derivative of cosine theta d theta k at theta equals 0 times theta k. That's our Taylor series around the origin.
Mm-hmm.
The kth derivative of cosine theta, right, well, now, what do we get? Let's see, we change sine every other time, I guess. Let's just do a few.
I understand the Taylor series. I'm trying to think how to explain this. But I see that we get the theta to the k part,
uh-huh.
We get the 1 over k factorial part,
right.
And I see how the sine of the kth derivative of the cosine
uh-huh.
and what we have up there match,
because
we have the minus 1 to the x.
Yeah.
But I for some reason,
where is the
cosine itself? You know, does that make sense?
You evaluate
these coefficients at 0. We're expanding around 0, so cosine and sine are going to be plus or minus 1.
This
is 0 at the origin. This is 1.
Okay. Oh man. Okay.
Yeah, at some point, you need to see this, right? And,
yeah.
You know. Okay. Now you see.
Okay.
Good
man. All right.
Yeah, so you don't see a cosine in there, but
there it is.
But the exponential is a magical function. You know, the exponential of a complex number gives you hyperbolic things and circular things and, nice things, good stuff. Were there other questions?
Yes, you made your question.
Yeah, let's do the rotation group in 3 dimensions. Oh boy. I need to hear a quorum of oh boy. you guys want to go? I mean, whatever you like. We went pretty long on Wednesday. You're probably still tired. But, you're in? Okay. Nope. You in? Okay. That's a quorum. Sorry, guys. Okay. Let's do the procedure in 3 dimensions. Then we should do the Lorentz group, which is it's a 6-dimensional group. It's 4 dimensions, right? It's a pseudo rotation, but everything will work just the same. So might as well just look at these. We can do SL2C. We can just find explicit representations of the groups until we're just bored silly with it.
I remember seeing this at the same time I was trying to take my Calc 1 class. A year and a half ago, met you, and
we
were working.
We went through this. How are we doing? Can I erase anything yet?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay.
So that was before I knew what I was in for.
Okay. So. All right, which do you want to do? Do you want to do the 2x2 complex matrices, or do you want to do the 3x3 real ones?
Real.
3x3 real.
Okay. Sorry,
that's lame.
The others are easier.
Actually, that's okay. What we want is SO3. The special orthogonal group in 3 dimensions. What we want are the... we've got x dot x in 3 dimensions now. That's our Euclidean norm of a 3-vector x squared, and we're going to demand that be the same as the norm of our x prime, our rotated vector. Quick, what's the requirement for the generators? What kind of matrices is it going to be?
Yeah.
That whole calculation goes through exactly as before. They've got to be anti-symmetric. Do you want to see it?
Is it
Okay. So, all right. So we have some transformation matrices. What do you want to call them? O, lambda, or G? Okay. So our X prime 3 vector is now, let's use xi tilde, let me call it, is going to be lambda ij xj. This time ij so on equal 1, 2, 3. And for to preserve the norm, our Euclidean metric is still a Kronecker. It's a 3x3 Kronecker. We have to have this condition. There's our norm squared, and now we put in lambdas for this: I J lambda I K lambda J L X K X L has to be. I'm going to change the names of the indices to KL, so everything's the same, XK, XL. And that is only true if delta IJ, lambda IK, lambda JL is equal to delta KL. So that's the condition on an element of SO3, that it be an element of SO3. Represented as a 3x3 real matrix. Now, for the infinitesimal case, I'm going to let lambda ij be the identity plus some small epsilon ij. Right? The components, epsilon ij is a 3x3 real matrix with small components. So all 9 components have to be small numbers. Much less than 1. Then our condition for the group is delta ij, Kronecker ik plus epsilon ik, Kronecker jl plus epsilon jl has to be Kronecker kl. And we multiply it out and we get a Kronecker kl from the two. I'm sorry, we get a delta KL from the two Kronekers. And then this metric lowers the I on this term to give us epsilon JK. And then we have a Kroneker JL. And then the other cross term, this metric lowers the J to become an I, so we have Kroneker IK epsilon sub IL. And then we have order epsilon squared, which is irrelevant because we're working to linear order. This tells us that epsilon, the J is replaced by an L, so epsilon LK plus here we get epsilon KL has to be zero, so once again the generators have to be anti-symmetric. This is always what we get, even if the metric has minus signs in it. The minus signs are incorporated in lowering the index. So we use the metric to lower an index, and whether that metric has ones or is all ones or has ones and minus signs, you're always going to get anti-symmetry of the doubly covariant infinitesimal generator. So now we need to write a general anti-symmetric 3x3. So we need to consider all such things. Well, let's choose some. I want to name these things.
You got 3 independent cases, right?
Uh-huh. Let's choose this one. And let me think. I want to try 1, 0, minus 1. I'm hoping I can choose these so I get the names right. I want to call this JX, because I'm thinking this little 2x2 down here is going to generate a rotation in the XY plane, which has X as the axis. So I'm going to think of it as a rotation around the X axis. I'm explicitly using the
what I know about three dimensions and what we just found about two. Well, yeah, this looks pretty good. Then what I call JY, I'm guessing, is going to be this one. And my third one I'm going to take to be this. Now, I can take any three independent anti-symmetric matrices here. It doesn't have to be these three. Right? As long as a linear combination of them gives me an arbitrary anti-symmetric 3x3, it's going to work. So it doesn't matter what you choose here. This is a convenient choice. Let me show you where this notation actually comes from.
Is it solvable for every choice, though?
What's that?
I mean, I know it's possible for every choice, but is it always solvable? Like, if you choose these differently, you're going to get some pretty ugly summations that might not come out to be anything we can work with.
Well, all I'm going to do is take an arbitrary linear combination of them anyway. So all you're really worrying about then is how the parameters, you know, the parameters are the linear coefficients that combine them. You'd like those parameters to correspond to something that you can picture geometrically back in your three space. So you'd like them to correspond to angles of rotation around those three axes. Well, that'll work here. Another convenient choice of parameters is an axis of rotation and an angle around the axis. You know, there are various choices of parameters that work. You could choose Euler angles if you were remotely able to. I'm not sure what they would end up being here. But, you know, the Euler angles are a perfectly good choice of three parameters to parameterize the rotation group. It's just hard to see what the generators would be without writing the general transformation matrix in terms of Euler angles or pulling it out of Goldstein and making them all infinitesimal and seeing what the corresponding generators were. You could do that. You could go to Goldstein. There's a good problem for you. There's an exercise. Go to Goldstein. Find the an element of SO3, a general 3x3 rotation matrix in terms of the three Euler angles. It's a ghastly thing in sines and cosines. Find the three infinitesimal generators. That would be fun.
It's actually an easy problem.
Yeah.
Right. I'll see if I can, you know, find the form of that matrix and put it on the web. So,
you know, so work it backwards, then you can do it.
Okay. But what we want to do, notice that what I've chosen here, J sub I is epsilon ijk. Right. You know, think of this as epsilon sub I, you know, matrix jk, you know, if you raise an index. So, let me think. Here's the way to write it. The jk component of j sub I. So, if I is 1, we're looking at this one, then epsilon ijk, j and k have to be 2 and 3. If j is 2, row 2, column 3, I've got the signs exactly backwards. So let me flip the signs here. Oh, yeah, that's right. This is what I want. Okay, flip all the signs. Now I think it's right. So if I is 2, then I get a plus 1 for j equals 3, k equals 1. Row 3, column 1. Good. There we go. So using the Levi-Civita tensor in three dimensions happens to be a really clever way to choose these. All right. Yeah, well, you know, we can even... let's see. Taking powers might be easier that way. Well, never mind that. We'll just do it. So, do you want to see that derivation of the exponential again? Should we go straight to the exponential?
Let's hit the derivation again. I'm remembering it. I just want to see.
So, for a finite transformation, let's see. We call this thing lambda at And what do we want to call these? Let's just call them, I don't know what to call the parameters. V1, V2, V3. Three real parameters, V1, V2, V3. It's going to be the limit as n goes to infinity of the identity plus a linear combination of these, let me call it V dot J, to the n. Where, let's make this epsilon dot J, where epsilon is epsilon 1, epsilon 2, epsilon 3, where n epsilon, the limit as n goes to infinity, epsilon goes to 0, is equal to the vector V. That gives us our three parameters. And so what we want to do is the binomial theorem on that thing. So lambda at, let's just call it vector V, is going to be the limit of the sum k equals 0 to n, limit on n, of 1 over k factorial, binomial theorem, n factorial, k factorial, n minus k factorial. Then we get epsilon dot j to the k identity to the n minus k. Anybody have any question on the expansion of the binomial power thing? Really? Bah. Okay. So, we can draw out the one. What we need to do is write this as the limit of k equals 0 to n. Then we have n factorial, k factorial, n minus k factorial. Then I'm going to put a 1 over n to the k and write this as v dot j. Okay, because that's what we'll get in the limit. I'm thinking ahead to n epsilon becoming v. The 1 goes away. So notice that the combinatorics work out exactly as before. I'm erasing them. it's exactly this same calculation with those combinatoric factors. We're going to end up with that v dot j to the k here. I'll write out a couple of steps. So lambda of the limit n goes to infinity, sum k equals 0 to n. Then we, 1 over k factorial is just 5. Then we have n minus 1, n minus 2, n minus k plus 1 over n and n and n and n. And then we have v dot j to the k. And in the limit, all of that's going to go to 1. And this becomes the sum k equals 0 to infinity, 1 over k factorial, v dot j to the k, and that is what we call e to the v dot j. So we're raising some matrix to powers, taking those powers times 1 over k factorial, summing over all k. That's the power series, the Taylor series for an exponential. So all we have to really do is figure out what the exponential of v dot j is. It's not actually too bad. We just work out a few powers and we'll start to see a pattern to it. So, v dot j is what? It's going to be, all right, Z1 times this, V2 times that, plus V3 times that. So we have 0, V3, minus V2, minus V3, 0, V1, V2, minus V1, 0. And we want to take that, well, let's square it.
See what happens.
So, it's sort of messy. Let's see. This column dotted into that one, so we're going to get minus V3 squared, minus V2 squared. Then, let's see. This column and that row, we get, V1, V2? Yeah. And then this column and that row, we're going to get V1, V3. Then middle column, first row, V1, V2. Middle column, middle row, we get minus V3 squared, minus V1 squared. Then middle column, bottom row, V2, V3. Then up top, V1, V3. And here in the middle, V2, V3. And finally, last column, bottom row, we get minus V1 squared minus V2 squared.
That's sort of messy, but...
it's symmetric.
Yeah, it's symmetric. You know, there's a lot of sort of pattern to it. I could write this in indices as the thing that's missing here is, if we had V1, V1, V2, V2, and V3, V3, then we just have VI, VJ minus, and then the thing we put in is V1, V1, so we have to subtract it. So V squared times the identity. So that's not a bad way to write it, or write it as a Kronecker here. Kronecker IJ.
Okay.
I think that's a tidier way to write it.
What are the V's again?
The V's are our three real parameters. There's a limit of N times this infinitesimal vector. It's just an infinitesimal linear combination of these times n in the limit. Okay, so that's not too bad. That's a nice thing to do, except it's a little hard to multiply that by another v dot j. So let's multiply another one. You get over here.
Yeah.
I suppose I could be clever about it.
Well, the metric is primitive.
You know, if I were to use this form, it might actually be a little easier. But let me just go ahead and multiply another. So we have 0, which one is on here? V3. Times that thing. Yuck. Let's see.
Yeah, V1, V2, V3. It's all going to be 1, 2, 3, 1, 2, 3.
The V squared Kronecker just gives me this. So let me just do the VI, VJ thing.
V1, V1, row 1, column 2, row 1, column 3. Is that right?
Yeah.
V2, V1. V2, V2, V3, V3, V1, V3, V2, V3, V3.
And then we're going to have minus V squared times V dot J. when we multiply by that identity matrix. So this is V dot J cubed. And we multiply it out and see what happens. So here we're going to get V1, V2, V3. There we're going to get minus V1, V2, V3. First thing is zero. And here, minus V1 squared times V3 plus V1 squared times V3. That one's zero. This is really promising. V1 squared V2 minus V1 squared V2. That's zero. This one, V2 squared V3 minus V2 squared V3. What are we doing here? Why is this vanishing? What this is, you know, that's zero. Yeah. We've got VI, VJ. This thing is epsilon, VK with epsilon K, IJ components. So we have VI, VJ, VK, epsilon, you know, IJK. Anti-symmetry, you know, V crust, you know, that's really zero. So you're anti-symmetrizing a thing with itself. It's V cross V, dotted with V. Okay, so that's zero, and the result is minus V squared times V dot J. And we're done with taking powers, right? Because we're back to our original matrix, which times some factor. No problem with factor, it's just factor. So we can figure out what any power is. By the time we cube, we've come back to the same thing with the factors, so we just have to keep track of the factors. So there are two things we get. We're either going to get this or a multiple of the original thing. So we can probably figure out what it is. So lambda of V has to be the sum K equals 0 to infinity, 1 over K factorial V dot J to the K. And let's do the even and odd series, right? Because to the zeroth power, we have a 1. To the first power, we have a V dot J. To the third power, we have a V dot J. Every odd power is going to be proportional to V dot J. So the sum over S equals 0 to infinity, 1 over 2S plus 1 factorial, the odd powers, we're going to have just a plain V dot J, and then we have to figure out what the factor is. Well, when S is 0, it's just 1. Each time we multiply by 2 more factors, V dot J squared, we're going to pick up a minus V squared. So we'll have minus V squared, and that'll be to the S power. And let's just check that that's right. How many V's are there? There are 2S plus 1. So we have the right number of V's. So quick check on getting these powers right. So we're good on that. Now, here we have a little bit of disparity because V dot J squared is this funny thing. And any subsequent even power is going to be proportional to that thing. Fine, no problem. But to the zero power, we only have an identity. So when K is zero, we have just an identity. Then we have the sum S equals 1 to infinity of 1 over 2S factorial. And now we're gonna be picking up these factors of minus V squared. Okay, so once we get to cubed, we're going to have one of these factors. So when we get to fourth, we're going to have one of these factors. So when S is 2, we're going to have one of these. Is that bad? Let's see. We have minus V squared to the have a feeling it does minus 1. Let's check that. I want to check that power. But then we have this matrix down here. We have VI, VJ, minus V squared times the identity. Let me write it as the identity. Actually, this is one up and one down index. This should be a V down, and this is a Kronecker here, delta IJ. There's V to the 2S minus 2 here, plus 2 there, so we have V to the 2S. So I believe we've got the right power.
And then the identity just pulls out. There's nothing on it.
Which, this one?
Yeah.
That's when K equals 0. K equals 0, everything is 1 here.
Yeah.
So there's just an identity. When K equals 1, that's here. When K equals 2, that's the first term here. So this is 2, 4, 6, 8, and so on. So it isn't quite as simple as before, but it's not actually that, because we can sum this first one. We have a V dot J that comes out. Then we have a thing to the S power. We have minus 1 to the S. We have odd powers. What power would we really like here? What should it be? There's a nice... I'm now remembering the nice way to write Z. It's inconvenient to have a vector squared to a power. So, before we do this, let Z equal some parameter theta times a unit vector where n dot n is 1. That's still an arbitrary 3 vector. N is an arbitrary unit vector. It gives us some direction. And then theta is just the magnitude of V. So then I can write V squared as theta squared, period. And that's just a pound. That's just the real number squared. So then this just becomes the 2s power of theta. So it's a little bit simpler. Good here? Then what we get is lambda of, now I'm writing it as, it's still 3 parameters because it takes 2 angles to specify a unit vector direction, and then here's a third parameter. So 3 real parameters. Then this first sum, we have V dot J. I can write that as V dot J is now theta n hat dot J. So I pull out another theta. And notice that here I've got an odd factorial. And what I would really like is an odd power of theta. Well, if I pull a theta from here, then I have theta to the 2s plus 1. So that first sum is going to be n hat dot J times the sum of s equals 0 to infinity, 1 over 2s plus 1 factorial. Then we have minus 1 to the s, and we have theta to the 2s plus 1. That looks pretty good. Then we have a 1. We have an identity matrix. And then we have this thing. Let's look at this identity matrix and see if we can combine it with that one. So,
should give us 0, right?
What's that?
Should give us 0, right?
What's 0?
Never mind.
let's see, we've got a v squared to the s here. We've got a minus v squared to the s. That's minus 1 to the s times theta to the 2s. That's just right. And then when s is 0, we have this 1. So for that term, it's going to be cosine theta. Yeah, it just depends on the norm theta. It doesn't depend on v dot anything. Then we have to worry about this vi vj thing. And what's the coefficient here? Well, let's write that as ni nj. So if the outer product is two unit vectors. So we get a theta squared here. So we have theta to the 2s minus 2 plus 2 here is theta to the 2s. There's a minus 1 to the s minus 1. So if I pull out a minus sign here, I get minus 1 to the s, and that gives me a cosine. Does everybody follow and agree with all of this? And then the top one gives a sign. So a general rotation, we're hoping by an angle theta around a direction n, but we'll see, is the identity cos theta minus ni nj cos theta plus n dot j sine theta. This 1 minus ni nj is a projection operator orthogonal to n. So notice Kronecker ij minus ni nj. If I square that, jk minus nj and k, I get Kronecker ik minus nink minus nink plus nj squared is 1 because it's a unit vector, so I get plus ninj is equal to itself. So an operator that squares to itself, a symmetric operator that squares to itself, is a projection operator. And if we notice further, delta I j minus n I n j acting on anything in the n j direction, we get here, we get n I minus here, n j dot n j is 1, n I is 0. So it kills the n direction. It's a projection operator perpendicular to, guess what? The axis of rotation. So this operator, this 1 minus ni and j, is projecting perpendicular to the axis of rotation. So that matrix is going to act on some vector. So we've got our n hat this way. We want to know what happens to some x, y, z vector here. Well, we take the orthogonal part times cos theta, and then we take the n dot j part. Well, that's the anti-symmetric part in the direction of n, and that's going to be the sine theta. Let's see, what does that look like? You know, okay, what this is, remember, this is ni, but j is epsilon ijk. So what this is a matrix that's orthogonal to n as well, but it's also going to be orthogonal to this thing, I think. It's the third direction. It's the third axis out like this. Let's see, how would I say it?
If you use instead of ni, you use like nk, and you can see that it's orthogonal to the first one because you got ij there and an e.
Yeah. You know. Okay. Let's suppose we let this act on some general vector x. Let's see what's happening. All right, we have 1 minus ni and j acting on xj is x I minus n dot x times x. That's just the projection of x minus the part, we're subtracting off the part parallel to n. So this is the part of the x that, this is x. We're getting the part of it that's perpendicular to n. Now, if we look at n dot j acting on x, this is equal to ni epsilon ij k acting on x k, that's equal to minus epsilon j I k n I x k, that's minus n cross x. So that's also perpendicular to x, but that's perpendicular to both x and n, so it's out of the plane. So that is a vector perpendicular to both of these two. So we've got this orthonormal system, n, and the part of x perpendicular to n, and something that's a cross product of the two. And what we're doing is writing a sine and cosine thing, rotating that perpendicular pair around that plane. So we're rotating in the plane orthogonal to n. So this is just what we expect a rotation to do. So we really have parameterized these things in terms of the angle theta of rotation around the axis of rotation given by a unit vector n. And this is, in fact, a very convenient way to write those matrices. You can write it as a 3x3, and it's just ugly. You know, this is a better way to write it. So we really have gotten a matrix, a 3x3 matrix, that accomplishes the general rotation.
Cool.
As I say, it's easier with 2x2s. We'll do that maybe next time.
You get a similar formula. It's just a little tidier business getting it.
So, let's see. You all owe me homework? No? Okay. Busy weekend?
Very busy.
Email me with questions. I mentioned, I think, my next dad is visiting for the weekend, so I'm not sure I'll be close to email all the time, but I'll probably have time to respond if you have questions as you're working through these problems. So, don't hesitate to pop me an email.
See everyone next week.
See you next week. Have a good weekend. Thank you.
Okay. I've got a question on quantum.
Sure.
I don't have any.
Okay. Any more questions on the
group here?
We'll get
a few questions on homework also.
Okay. We can
find another class, so I need to go ahead.
Yeah, it may help these guys if you want to ask. But,
okay, well, is there any component in differential form and an isometric? So, like, if you have the coefficient between four of the example two form,
yeah.
If you have the symmetric,
we take them to be anti-symmetric always. Yeah, so they are the anti-symmetric rank P covariant tensors.
And if you take a Hodge dual of a 3 form in a 2D space, how does that go to 0 2 dimensions?
There is no 3 form in 2 dimensions.
There is no 3 form in 2 dimensions. They're all 0.
So it's already 0 before you
start. So it's 0 before you start.
I'm pointing how it gets to 0.
Yeah.
And,
it's obvious you get a minus 1 form.
That's right.
Yeah. Sorry. Go ahead.
Let's see. For you could Hodge rule of the exactly a wedge product between the two forms, three forms. I don't get the I get negative 1 to the 15th instead of negative 1 to the
9th. It's off by a sign, right? What is the problem you have? You're taking a wedge product of a dual of a what?
No, I think you're a wedge product of two three forms.
Yeah. Wedge product of two three forms. Okay.
Yeah.
So omega and eta are elements of lambda 3. But our dimension, what's our dimension? Greater than 3, I guess, or greater than...
Yeah, 3.
It'll be 0
then.
N equals 3, that'll be 0.
Yeah.
Right, so if we want to consider omega wedge eta, let's let N be greater than or equal to 6.
Direct, yeah.
That's the only way we'll get something non-zero. Have we answered the question already, or
no?
Okay, so we want to dual with this, or
no? We just want to
see what it is.
Yeah.
Oh, okay. All right.
Just
so
sign on the sign. We take the address question.
I see. When we
flip
it, yeah, okay. I see. So we've got omega I J K D X I wedge D X J wedge D X K wedge. Let's see. Wedged with eta L M N D X L wedge D X M wedge D X N. So these are the two things we're wedging. You could have factorials if you wanted, but it doesn't matter. We're always free to pull these coefficients to the front if we like. L, M, N. And then we have six, you know, DXs here. I, J, DX, K, DX, L, DX, M, DX, N. Now, what we want to do is get all three of these back in front of all three of those. We move them one at a time. I, J, K.
Oh, yeah.
L, M, N. So, Let's just do one at a time. If I move this one past 1, 2, 3, I'm going to get minus 1 cubed. Then I'll have DXL wedge DXI wedge DXJ wedge DXK. You can see why you eventually stop writing the wedge. DXM wedge DXN. Now I want to get the M over to here, between the L and the I.
Oh, no.
I want them in the same order.
Mm-hmm.
I've got L, M, N here, so I want L, M, N the first three. So I'm going to now have minus 1 to the 6. I'm going to get, I've got three more. I've got to pass 1, 2, 3, the I, J, K. So omega I, J, K, eta L, M, N, and then we have D, X, L, I don't need to pass that, then I'll bring the DXM to here, and then I have I, J, K, and still have N sitting out in the end. And finally, I'm going to bring this to here, and I'm going to pass 1, 2, 3, so I get another 3, so I end up with minus 1 to the 9. And then let me write it as L, M, N, omega, I, J. These are just numbers out here. Those I can write any way I like. But now I've got DX, L, DX, M, DX, N. Wedge, DX, I, DX, J, DX, K. And I can move the omega over and join those. I can write these first three with the eta as eta. So I have minus 1 to the 9th times eta is now first because these forms are first, wedge omega.
Now, if you go the other way, did you bring the DXI and bring it over to DXM?
I bring this through?
Yeah.
Ah.
That's what I'm talking about.
Okay. Let me just count that way.
be a different answer. Make a different exponent.
It'll be the same sign.